meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And good evening, everyone. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on satellite, Scared Monkeys Radio, on the internet, on Access Communications Channel 7, wherever you can pick us up. This comes from the America's Most Wanted webpage. Stacy Peterson, the 23-year-old wife of longtime Bolingbrook, Illinois police officer Sergeant Drew Peterson, vanished on Sunday, October 28, 2007. Police say that Stacy may have left the house in a jogging suit and was supposed to be headed to a relative's home. She never made it. Peterson claims he received a phone call from Stacy on Sunday at 9 p.m., but no one else heard from her after the alleged Sunday morning phone call. Stacy's family has asked the Illinois State Police to look into her disappearance. Since the husband is a police officer with the local police department, he has since been suspended. Pam Bosco is the family representative for Stacy Peterson, and she joins me now. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
I'm sorry to bring you on in circumstances like this. This must be something that you never thought in your life that you would have a role to do. Apparently, there was a press conference by you this afternoon that my satellite listeners may not have heard. Can you share that with us, and then we'll get right into the questions?
We spoke about the search effort went today, and mainly we try to keep that our focus on the search efforts. We really can't provide too much information on what the police effort is doing. They have their own investigation that they do.
Sure.
So when we relay the information, it's primarily about, just information coming forth to the public, and to keep requesting people come and join the effort that our church is centralized. And anything that's pertinent to what was discovered or that we can relate to the public, and just keep that in front of the public so they, you know.
The media have been doing a good job covering this. In fact, the media coverage is unbelievable down there. I'm sure you probably have lights and cameras all over the place. Tim Miller is going to be my next guest after I'm done interviewing with you. How does the family hold up in something like this? This must be incredibly difficult for them.
The hardest part of the whole thing is trying to keep it together and try to stay focused on, you know, what our goal is, you know, and so we primarily what we've discovered. So we're trying to do our best to
Pam, I'm losing your cell signal. Is it possible that you can move to another location, or
it is better?
It's better, but you seem to be breaking up as we're speaking.
Okay, is this better?
That seems to be okay.
Okay.
I only caught about half of your answer here, but as far as how the, you know, it may seem like a dumb question, but a lot of people are concerned and wondering how the family holds up with all the media scrutiny, plus the stress as far as what happened and the lack of answers.
Well, like I said, we're trying to stay focused on where we want to go with this. We have a lot of resources at our hands. We have the Tim Miller group here. We have all the connection he brings, including the boat, you know, the plane, the support network that he brings with us. So with that, we try to do the best we can to continue the search for Stacy Peterson, which is our ultimate goal, is to find her. So we, like I said, we continue trying to focus on the search efforts because we're hoping that will bring our answers sooner. We really don't have a whole lot of information being gathered from the police and support from the police, so all our efforts are primarily from the tip coming in for the tip line and what we find through the searches.
We're told that America's Most Wanted had quite a few tips that were called in on Saturday. Can you share any of that information with us, or has that just been passed on to the police?
That gets passed on to the police, and anything that we get primarily from our own tip lines. Like I said, the support that we receive from the police is very, very minimal. That's a primary concern that we have to continue our search to make them efficient, is we really need to have better communication with them so we're not doing this in fruitless searches. You know, we need to have better communication with them.
The media have been all over this case as far as coverage talking about Drew Peterson, talking about Stacy's disappearance, but we're not hearing a lot about Stacy. Tell us about Stacy.
She was a marvelous girl. She was very sweet, warm. She was definitely the caretaker, I would say, of the family. She was a young girl. Obviously, she met Drew when she was very, very young, and with that, I think, was very naive. I came to believe her and still call her a child, you know, in these terms. But a sweetheart of a girl. She adopted his two boys, plus had the two more with him. So again, she was always about family. She maintained connection with everybody in her family, including her aunt in California. So she was a lovely, lovely, warm, sweet girl.
What we're hearing and what we're seeing on TV is probably only part of the story, I'm sure. My listeners have emailed me all day to ask you the question as far as the children and the safety of the children. What can you tell us about that?
I wish I had more information in that regard. You really don't have a whole lot of information. They are still in under the care of Drew, and we don't see them or hear from them. So, you know, I can't offer you more than that. We wish we had more communication with them and could see them, but I don't think that's possible at this point.
The difficulty of this whole situation, and I don't think it can get any worse for you now than what it is, but seeing a young 17-year-old girl involved with an older gentleman, the family had to have been concerned for quite some time now. Was there ever any communication between Stacy and yourself or other family members saying that she wanted help and needed to get out of the relationship?
In the very beginning, I don't think it started like that. I have to say that it maybe was for the last year and a half. We started getting more insight from her, and her concerns were obviously started to get more pronounced towards the end of the relationship. I did hear from her the Thursday before she disappeared, and she did express obviously the concerns that she's expressed to the whole family. Everyone can relate the same story. But when she called me on Thursday, she said that she was looking to move into a rental property I had and move out legitimately. Through a rental, you know, with her children, and I advised her to seek legal counsel, do it correctly, because you don't want to lose the risk of losing the children. So never in that conversation did I hear her say that she was going to run, she was going to do this. She was doing it as any other woman would, under the circumstances, do it right by law, you know, to make sure she maintained a connection and had her children.
Now, this may be a difficult question for you to answer, and you may not want to answer it, but give me your opinion and thoughts on Drew Peterson before the situation and then after.
You know, that's something I really can't comment on, because my relationship with him was rather benign. I really didn't have much of a relationship with him. I was mostly with Stacy and around the children and with her sister Cassandra. As I said, I really, as him as a person, he was rather, just like I said, benign. He was just Drew, a man of very few words.
A non-issue, I guess.
Yeah, it was a non-issue at that point.
The search effort is continuing. What can you tell us about what will be happening in the next few days?
We're going to continue our search efforts. We have a lot more waterways to cover. Every day we get tips through the tip line that we continue to read through and target the ones that are most concerned. We have areas to cover tomorrow based on new technology or information that was given to us today, and we'll do that tomorrow. And then we also continue the ground searches.
Has your family been in contact with the family of the other wife, I guess I could call her, who sadly passed away in a bathtub, and the investigation into her death is being relooked at?
Yes, we do talk to them. We have spoken to them. We offer our condolences on the whole situation that they're having to relive tomorrow and probably the next few days over. And I can't imagine the emotions they're going to be going through. And again, we just offer them our support, and we're there for them.
with Peterson being in a position of trust as a law enforcement officer, and maybe the intimidation factor that could be part of that, are you able to comment as far as the investigation, the way that it first was looked at and the way that it is now, and the fact that Peterson was a police officer before he was suspended?
Are you talking with the Peterson case?
Right.
Oh. I don't know if they had any input on it. You know, if, we're all suspicious of it, right, because of the past reports on what happened to the Savio. So I can only assume that, you know, based on that, is history going to repeat itself? I don't know. We are concerned about that. We have thought about FBI involvement, how to do that. Is it even required at this point?
Mm-hmm. Have any family members on your side, Stacy's side, had contact with Drew here in the last couple of days?
We at one point, we did have some family members try to go, and they did enter his house to get Bettina's ashes, which was the sister to Stacy and Cassandra.
Mm-hmm.
She passed away this past year from colon cancer. And there is a very much emotional tie to those, and I imagine that the family wanted those back sooner than later, depending upon what was going to happen with the situation.
And how was Peterson? Was he cooperative?
Yes, and I don't think we were expecting much else from him. He wasn't really going to raise any concerns at this point. It would have been a terrible decision if he did, so I think he was acting as he should have under the circumstances.
If you had a message for anyone out there that had information regarding the disappearance of Stacy, what would that message be?
Come forward. It's very private. We do the best we can to keep everything private. And we're just hoping that for the benefit of the family and everyone involved, that you come forward and help us with these searches.
And if you had a message, Pam, for law enforcement when it comes to this investigation, what would that be?
We'd like them to step forward, ensure us that they are doing their best, and communicate better with us. We are asking for additional support, especially during these searches. We do have equipment on the boat that needs to be helped with, you know, the boat searches, and they can offer any support, which I've heard has been done on other search efforts, on other people. I think they have more police involvement. I don't think we've really seen on this point. So, yeah, I'm requesting more support from the police department.
And what can we in the media do better for you?
Just keep getting the word out. The searches are there. The tip line's there. The website's there. Go into all of those. Anyone who has any information, call in for that.
Okay. And is there a special tip line set up? I know people can call call America's Most Wanted and other places, but is there a special tip line set up?
Yes. If you go to the website, it's all on that information site.
And the website is?
www.findstacypeterson.com.
Pam Bosco, family spokesman for Stacy Peterson, joins us in regards to the investigation of her disappearance. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right. We're going to be back in just a minute, and we're going to cover a good portion of tonight's program with this disappearance of Stacy Peterson. Tim Miller from Texas EquiSearch will join us to talk about his involvement in the search and some other cases that Texas EquiSearch is working on. And a little later on, Wendy Murphy, former DA, law professor, and author of And Justice for Some, will be here. And then Susan Murphy Milano will be here. She's the author of a book, Moving Out, Moving On. And the webpage there is movingoutmovingon.com. And I want you to go and check out that webpage right now. Keeping with this theme, and it's a difficult theme for sure, her mom, okay, in January 1989, Susan's father, a Chicago violent crimes police officer, police detective, murdered her mother, then took his own life. That very night after discovering the body, she vowed to change the way society viewed domestic violence and broken relationships. So we will have Susan Murphy Milano on to talk about her new book, Moving Out, Moving On. Again, the website is movingoutmovingon.com, and talk about the eerie similarities to this case. Police officer, Chicago area. the whole bit, and how domestic violence plays a role in this. My name's Dana Pretzer. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
And we're back, continuing on with this evening's investigation into the disappearance of Stacy Peterson and other missing persons. It's always a pleasure to have Tim Miller, who is the founder of Texas EquiSearch, join us. Tim's been working on several cases, including Brandy Laurent, Stacy Peterson, as we've been talking about, and Benjamin Stanford. And it's nice to have Tim on the air with us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You're busy as usual. It's unfortunate to keep you busy like this, but it's very fortunate that you're out there. Let's talk about Stacy Peterson. We just had Pam Bosco on talking about the case. What can you tell us?
Incredible financially, physically, emotionally draining case. We've kind of backsized or, downsized the ground search. We're really concentrating in the water right now. We've got, Dennis and Tammy Waters have been up there for now over a week doing everything in the water with their sonar equipment, and we brought some other sonar equipment, ROV equipment, in there today. We covered many, many, many square miles up there on the ground, and about every day we was in the water on the land and in the air looking at stuff, and so far I've come up empty-handed, and I was kind of optimistic on that case going into it, and I still am. I still am. I think it's not over till it's over, and we'll continue to bring resources in. And when I get done with the case I'm doing down here in Alabama right now, I want to go ahead and get back up there to Illinois and continue that search for Stacy.
Now, you've worked on a couple of cases, or not you by yourself, but Texas EquiSearch have worked on a couple of cases where police officers have been suspects or involved heavily in the case as persons of interest. How difficult is that for you and your organization when it comes to cooperation?
We got plenty of cooperation in Illinois. I actually had meetings with the Illinois State Police that lasted 4 hours, and got a lot of information from them that they felt as though it would be helpful in our search efforts and everything. We got different calls and leads in. All in all, we had a good working relationship with them. A little bit better than we had in Canton, Ohio on Jesse Davis' case. But, we can't complain about Illinois. They made sure that we had some rooms comped, and our food was taken care of most of the time and everything, and they welcomed us. And in fact, at a press conference, they said how blessed they were to have EquiSearch up there doing a search so they could focus more on the investigation. And that means a lot coming from law enforcement. So and more law enforcement starting to work with us. And in fact, we did a case only a month prior to that in Champaign, Illinois, for Naomi Arnett, had been missing for 3 months, basically, and got up there and went there and found her remains in a day and a half, which, so I know a detective in Champaign called the detectives in with Illinois State Police and stuff and let them know what a good job we did, and I think some other law enforcement agencies called them, so they took them in, they took us in with pretty much welcome arms, and the community all came together, and we did everything right in Stacy's case, except find her.
Yeah. And
if we could do anything different, I don't think there'd be anything we'd do different, that we just haven't been to the right spot yet, and I anticipate we will get there.
Yeah, eventually, there's always answers, sadly. A lot of the times, the answers aren't what the family was looking for, but at least they're able to get some closure. One thing that I forgot to mention, and I see it on your webpage, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about it, is about baby Grace. There's a story that, tugs at, a lot of people's heartstrings, including, I'm sure, your own and other officers. Tell us a little bit about baby Grace.
Well, we got a call about a little baby being found, and actually that was only 7 or 8 miles from our office. A little baby was found in Galveston Bay in the water, And they found those had been there 2+ weeks, found in a plastic container. And in the very beginning, all we had was a picture of a pair of shoes and a container. And we got that up on our website and got stuff out. And we was actually been working looking for a 5-year-old little girl since the first part of June. So we thought possibility maybe that was the girl, and
right.
It ended up it wasn't. And then they put their composite drawing together. They reconstructed the skull, did the composite drawing, and then when that picture came out, it just made this little baby so much more real. And then they named her little baby Grace because she doesn't have a name. And she was actually found off of a little island out in Galveston Bay, and we went ahead and built her a cross at our office and decorated her little cross and put a plaque on it, you know, Baby Grace, and went out there and had a prayer vigil. Many, many, many people showed up, went out there with law enforcement and put her cross up on that little island, and you know, hopefully one of these days we can go down there to that cross again and take that plaque off and put her real name on there. But as of now, it's been 2 weeks, still not any closer to getting her identified than they were in their beginning. There's I know they're working hard on it. They're taking every single call that comes in on it, but it was just one of them heartbreaking things, and especially when you see the picture of a little girl that,
absolutely,
you know, what they feel as though she looks like. And it's it was just a heartbreaking case, and it took its toll on everybody in my office there for a few days, that's for sure. And you know, we still think about it every day. In fact, before you called, I was talking to Cheryl at my office, and Michael Berry, which is a detective on that case, was at our office for about 2 hours a day looking at some things and talking to Cheryl. And they was actually taking pictures of everybody there that came to the ceremony and, you know, if they could find out who they were, maybe if they had any involvement and stuff. So, yeah, they were at our office for about 2 hours again today. So that case is far from being over, but, you know, it's just one of them little precious babies that we've never going to have the opportunity to get to know, and hopefully someday she can at least have a name and we can really say goodbye to her.
Yeah, for sure. Tim Miller's here from Texas Equisearch. Now, you're in Alabama getting started to look for Ben Stanford. Tell us about that case.
Ben Stanford, he is 17 years old, nice-looking young man, going to private school. Didn't appear as though it was, you know, any problems that any other teenagers don't have, of course. And, you know, influential family. Father owns a car dealership. Mother's in real estate business. Grandfather is a state senator here in Illinois. And Ben's vehicle was found about 70 miles from here in Georgia along Interstate 20. Ben has not been located.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shows us all that nobody is exempt,
right,
from something happening to their children. You think you got everything in the world, but then all of a sudden, you know, you wake up and your child's not there, and then what do you do? And I mean, we were so involved in Ohio on Stacey Peterson case, and then when we got this call, it was like, you know what, we've done everything we can do up there. We're going to keep the water switch going, and we're going to get right down here in Alabama. In fact, I got home late last night, threw clothes in the washing machine, threw them in the dryer, got up very, very early this morning, ran out the door. My wife needed a little bit of cash. I ran to my truck and grabbed my wallet. I gave her some cash, jumped in my truck, and took off. And my wife called me about 45 minutes later. She says, "Do you realize you left your suitcase on the patio?" So I got on an airplane with no clothes. And actually, Beth Holloway Twitty is over here helping on this search, too. It's close to Birmingham. Beth and I have been at the family's house all day long. Beth is doing a lot of stuff to help organize the search for Ben. She's been a tremendous, tremendous help. And looks like we're going to have a big turnout tomorrow to get started. And again, we're holding on to, you know, all the hope you can hold on to, but and I told Dad and Granddad both that we won't sugarcoat anything.
Right.
Because we know the more time that goes by, the, you know, better chances there are not going to be coming home alive. But regardless, we have to find them. We have to get out there and search for them. And so anyhow, the official search is going to start tomorrow for Ben. And then we've got Justin up there in Lake Snellville, Georgia, too, that was at that Bill's Wild West that has disappeared. They put us on that, so we're going to get involved in that one also. And we just wonder how many of these cases we can continue doing, and we're just spread so thin across the country that, you know, we got to kind of regroup and start reaching out to our residents and having our listeners fill out them applications and start getting involved, because it's pretty obvious we're going to be in your neighborhood one day.
Yeah.
And we're going to need your help.
Absolutely. And how can people get to your webpage, Tim?
Just go to our website, www.txeq.org, and they can make donations on there. They can fill out applications. They can see what we're doing. And unfortunately, we're doing more than we ever anticipated we would do. Dana, you know what? We are now on, I believe, case number 794 or 795.
Wow.
So before the end of the year, we're going to be way over 800 cases that we've worked in 7 years. And, you know, the first 2.5 years, we did very little. So, again, I made a promise to God years ago that I'd never leave a family alone. But, Dana, I never knew that there was going to be this many families. And it's just heartbreaking at times. But you wonder how we're going to continue doing it, but somehow or another we do. And you know, we just need to continue getting the support of the listeners and their prayers need to go out to all these families, and we need all the help that we can get.
Well, the strength is of you, your organization, and the type of person like yourself, and you're mentioning Beth Holloway Twitty, both of you, you know, victims yourselves, your family members, your loved ones have been taken from this earth, sadly, yet you're able to go and support others through the experience of your own tragedy. Just before I let you go, Tim, I want you to comment on that a little bit. And I know you're a proud man. And
you know what? How about if we do this? You know what? Beth is sitting right here. In fact, we're eating. We're getting our plans together. And
I'd love to talk to her.
Yeah, if you don't mind, we can put Beth on the phone for a little bit.
Absolutely.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
Hi, Beth. I'm doing fine. And, you know, sadly, when you and I talk, there's always something negative to talk about. Yet there's a huge positive here. You're there helping to look for Ben Stanford, and you're working with the family. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved.
Well, I was several family friends had contacted me over the weekend and just were expressing concern over Ben's disappearance, and if there's any guidance or information, you know, connections that I could help the family make, you know, ask me if I would do that, and I said I'd be more than happy to. And Lynn, Ben's mom, called yesterday, and you know, we just began talking about the things that have already been done for Ben, and I just wanted to commit to, if I had any additional resources that maybe that I could connect him with, or any additional connections, whether it's through the media or some other capacity, that I would be, you know, willing to do that. And so that's kind of what we've done. Is then Tim Miller and I began to think about how could this, you know, be brought to this area and where Ben was last seen, and so he was ready to be mobilized, of course, in a heartbeat, and
right.
We've just been trying to get the word out today through the local media to enlist some ground searchers and persons with ATVs that could come and participate in a search effort this week. So that's kind of where we are right now, just in the planning stages. It's been pretty busy today, and so we're hoping for a good turnout tomorrow, and we can begin another massive search of that area.
You know, when I just before Tim passed the phone on to you, and I know Tim, and after interviewing you, you two are both probably the strongest people that I know, and you maybe don't like the compliments that get thrown your way sometimes because you're proud, but enable for you to go with a family when you are waiting for answers yourself and Tim and others is incredible. When you sit down with the family the first time, Beth, after the experience, the nightmare, for lack of a better term, that you've gone through, what are the first words that come out of your mouth for them? Of course, you can't give them false hope, or at least you try not to.
I think what I try to do is really not look too far ahead, but really look at all the small little steps that we need to take in order to, my goodness, just the search effort that will be underway tomorrow has taken a great deal of coordination and cooperation. You know, you've got to. So I think what I try to do is just try to stay focused on just the small steps, and I think they're just so important, and I think one thing I've learned in this journey for Natalie, there has been no step that I've taken that has been wasted. So,
right.
You know, every step that families take in searching for a loved one are very necessary. And something else is you can't make a wrong step. You know, and I like for them to feel comfortable in that, whether it's in making some more connections through media, or whether it's calling out for some additional resources maybe to be shared between different entities. I just think I like to encourage just to focus on the small steps and just make sure that they feel comfortable in that there's not a wrong step you can make. So some of them seem very small and tedious, but, you just want to look back and know that you have really proceeded forward. And as I hear everyone say, you've just can't overlook crossing your T's to dotting your I's. You just have to be extremely thorough in each step you take.
Absolutely. Listen, I'm not going to take up any more of your time. I want to thank you for coming on Unscripted. I didn't know that you were there. Thank Tim for me. You two are doing God's work, and you need to be commended. And we here at Scared Monkeys Radio support you 1,000%. You know that.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And just thank you for your continued support and all missing persons cases. It's just remarkable, and I think that it gives the family great comfort in knowing that others are standing strong with them in their time of need. So it's very comforting for the family.
Absolutely, we're here for you anytime, Beth. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, bye bye. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. That was a Unscripted surprise. We'll be right back here with Wendy Murphy.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
And that's right. We are back, continuing on with our feature tonight on the disappearance of the law enforcement officer's wife in Illinois, Stacy Peterson. I thought I'd bring on Wendy Murphy, former DA, law professor, and author of the new book, And Justice for Some. And you can just click on the link on our webpage to learn more about that and buy it, to talk about the perspective of a district attorney. When it comes to looking at a case like this, prosecuting or possibly prosecuting a police officer, how difficult that is. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Dana. It's great to be with you again.
Nice to have you here. We were going to talk a little bit about OJ tonight, but we've changed that. We'll try and get a couple of words about our friend the Juice on tonight. But I thought it'd be important to bring you on to talk a little bit more about this case, the Peterson wife. Now there's a second wife that is being exhumed, and some questions on the autopsy and whether or not there's a homicide investigation there. You're looking at a law enforcement officer, 29 years experience. The whole question of the blue wall of silence, it's actually sad to see how many law enforcement officers, 99.9% of them are good, but you got that 0.1% that we're hearing a lot about in the media. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there is some pretty good data out there that tells us law enforcement officials can have a, I don't want to say disproportionate compared to other jobs, but the truth is they do have issues with power and with how they have to manage their lives that I think increase the risk of battering at home or violence or, you know, inappropriate behavior. Because think about it, and this isn't meant to be sympathetic, but a lot of cops, they have to deal with thugs and murderers and rapists, and
right.
then they have to go home and just flip a switch and be normal. And I think sometimes because they're trained to be just such tough guys in their jobs, and they have to go home and be respectful and polite, some of them don't get it. Most of them do, and this is important. So I don't want it to be an excuse to say that this guy, Peterson, because he has a tough job as a cop, should somehow get a pass. In fact,
right.
cops are supposed to be super aware of their own issues when it comes to dealing harshly with criminals and then going home and behaving responsibly. Plus, they understand domestic violence very well because they're punishing those guys in their jobs all the time. They know how devastating the behavior is on families. And I think, frankly, for this guy, he's been a cop almost 30 years. There's no excuse. And what scares me the most is when it's a cop, and we've seen this with other cases, Dana, when it's a cop who kills or batters or does something horrible at home, what bothers me is they know damn well how to cover it up.
Yep.
They know how to make it look like an accident. They know how to get rid of the bodies because they've seen it in their careers.
Right.
And, you know, the horrible thing about this guy is he seems to have become even more arrogant over time. Remember, his third wife, this is his fourth wife who's now missing.
Right.
His third wife died in a very, I would call it, criminal circumstance. You know, she had a bludgeoned head. She died in a bathtub. There was no water. They called it an accident. Now they're reopening the case. They're exhuming her body. That's good. But you can just imagine, this was in 04. If this guy is a killer and a batterer, and he thought he got away with what looks to be a pretty obvious criminal offense in 04, that only makes these guys worse when they stay up and go, I can't believe I got away with that. Now I'm going to marry wife number four and beat the hell out of her, too.
Yeah.
I would not say this case is where we're going to see a blue wall of silence, though. Let me just say quickly about that. Most cops are good cops, and they don't like guys like this.
Exactly.
I mean, this guy is a thug. I looked at a few stories. He was apparently in trouble 20 years ago. He got in trouble for bribery-related charges. He, like, was opening his own investigations. A real, you know, God complex, soliciting drugs in exchange for information. The stuff he got in trouble for 20 years ago was very serious. And, you know, my opinion is he's the kind of guy, exactly the kind of guy you should never, ever, ever sign up to be a cop. So maybe the part of the story here is we need to figure out how to screen these guys out better, because it's a lot harder to fire them after they get the job because of their unions and so forth. I mean, this guy is now not working, right? So he's on leave. He's getting paid a ton of money, tax dollars. The public's money is going into his pocket right now, but he doesn't have to work, and he gets to keep his gun. I think that's a travesty, too.
Well, there's supposed to be legislation in states and provinces across North America that when you wear the badge and you're involved in a domestic situation, the gun is supposed to be taken from you, and you're supposed to be put on a desk while that investigation happens. But there's a huge perspective here as far as those married to law enforcement officers. And a little later on this evening, another guest of mine will talk about how her dad, the cop, killed her mom. And we see this image of the police officer, the wife who is getting the crap beat out of her on a daily basis, yet she's terrified to come forward or doesn't think she can come forward because nobody will believe her because hubby wears the uniform. How important is that to get that straightened out?
Oh, that's huge. And that's only part of the story. I mean, when you think about it, not only are women in general fearful of reporting because they literally think, I'm going to end up dead if I tell. And let's assume the person isn't a cop. Lots of women think, if I tell, he's going to kill me, so it's better not to tell. Then if you enter kids into the picture, and this family had four children, two that they had together and two from another relationship, but little kids in the family, then the moms think, I can't report because I'll end up homeless and my children won't have food and I'll be out on the sidewalk. So that's a general fear women have. Add to that. So in other words, women try to be better, and they try to behave, and they try to keep peace, and they try to limit the circumstances under which the guy explodes. That's how a lot of vetted women live, because they feel like they have no choice. Now you add to that problem or that series of problems, the very real fear when the batterer is a cop, that you're going to make that phone call and his friend is going to answer the phone, or his friend's boss is going to say, well, you know, he shouldn't do this, but we need him, he's a good cop, you know, he told us his wife was bitchy or whatever. You know, it's more than a chilling effect. Lots of women will say that they know, just like a cop can get pulled over while speeding, flash the badge and get a pass, the phone call is made where you know, a woman says, Charlie is beating me, please help me. Nine times out of ten, it's going to get chalked up as a private dispute. And I'm saying that happens in the real world, too, but even more so between cops. And very often, because the women who are being battered by cops face that extra hurdle, they're often dead before anybody actually takes that step to intervene. And that's not the, it's a slightly lower hurdle for women in the real world where their batterers are not cops. And I think that's part of why we've heard so many cases in the recent past of missing women and, oh, the husband was a cop. A missing woman or a woman is dead and the suspect is a cop. It literally takes death before somebody says, oh, my God, we should have done something. And all the red flags were there. We were saying it about the Peterson case. We've said it about so many other cases in the past. Oh, we should have known. All the red flags were there. Oh, she kept telling people she was afraid for her life. That's true in this case. This woman said, I am afraid for my life, and now she's missing. I suspect she's dead. And nobody did anything about it.
I interviewed Denise Brown last week, and she said very clearly all these years later, after O.J. got away with killing her sister, that she has zero faith in the system. She's a victim's advocate, the same as you are. And we see these cases in the media now with Peterson, nonstop coverage. How much is the faith in the system being destroyed here because of these cases, or do the public have enough sense to know that this is a rare case, it's high profile because it's a cop, but the system is still a pretty good one?
You know, I wish I could say something more hopeful than what I'm about to say, but as you know, my book, And Justice for Some, is all about why faith in the system is crucial and why we don't have it anymore. I mean, I think we're actually past the point of no return, and I think we're going to have to pretty soon reach a crisis and probably some kind of public rioting before anything significant happens, but I think we're close to that. I know Denise. I've met her and talked to her many times, and I really appreciate her work. She's cynical, as I am, and for good reason. The system doesn't work. That doesn't mean it never works, but on average, it doesn't work. And there are million different reasons why, but on average, when you ask any person who's been victimized, particularly a woman or a child or a parent of a victimized child, will you or did you or are you inclined to call the police in the aftermath of an incident, most of the time they're going to say no. Why should I? And what they mean by that is, if I call the police, there's a good chance they're not going to do anything. If the cops are good and they do something, the prosecutor probably won't press charges. If the prosecutor does proceed and charges are brought, there's going to be a plea bargain. If there isn't a plea bargain and the case goes to trial, the prosecutor is probably going to lose. The defense attorney is going to beat the hell out of me during the case. I'm going to get re-victimized,
right,
and we're likely not to win. And even if we win, the punishment is going to be a pittance. When, you know, when that's the message, and that is the message out there right now, that is the message. And when that's what the public is seeing, especially in high-profile cases where we really do get a strong sense of how things work, when that's the message we're getting, can you blame people for saying, if it happened to me, I wouldn't tell anyone, I wouldn't call, I wouldn't testify? You know, increasingly in Massachusetts, I think we've really reached a crisis. I think the last time we measured the numbers, over 40% of homicides in Boston went unsolved in one recent year. Oh, think about that.
Yeah.
40% of homicides unsolved. And I'm not talking about successful or unsuccessful prosecutions. I'm saying nobody was ever arrested. And that is indicative of a system in crisis. Cynicism is important. People acting out in vigilante style, although I don't support vigilantism, but the fact that we see vigilantes all over the place. I mean, what was the story I read today? Some young people literally beheaded a sex offender.
Right.
I really despise vigilantism, but I understand it, and I think the system has to understand what it means. It's a real canary in a coal mine. When people start taking the law into their own hands, it's because of cases like O.J. Simpson. It's because they've lost their trust. It's because, like most people, they don't believe in the rule of law anymore. There's no such thing as civility. Why should anybody treat anybody else with respect? There's no downside to disrespect. There's no downside to stealing. There's no downside to killing. That's the feeling that's out there. Now, there are pockets, and there are moments when that's not true, but on average, that's the sense I get, and I work in the field all the time.
In speaking of cases where there's a lot of cynicism and a lot of eyebrow raising, our old friend O.J. has been before the court here, and we're seeing a lot of news coverage. All the old characters are being brought out, Marsha Clark and Kato Kaelin and you name it. But it takes away, and it kind of angers me a bit, where you see probably one of the worst narcissistic personalities on this earth, O.J. Simpson, being almost glamorized to the point where he's in the media. The talk now is about him, poor OJ, being set up. Poor OJ, all he needs is one juror to feel sorry for him. And it's being taken away from what type of personality he is. He was found civilly liable for the death of two people. And now here we go again. How much is this damaging the system?
Well, that's a huge kettle of fish you're talking about. I mean, it's the fault of so many things. You know, making cases into some form of sick entertainment, it's our culture's fault. We all watch because we want to see OJ, and we don't know what works, but maybe someday he'll fall on his sword and say, I'm sorry, I did it, I'm guilty.
Right.
Forgive me. I don't know what we're waiting for with that guy. I think we're still amazed that he's as arrogant as he is, as defiant as he is, thumbing his nose every day, going out and being a celebrity and, you know, laughing like people are paying attention to him because he's a wonderful sports hero, when the only reason we're paying attention is because we just can't believe he slaughtered his wife and acts like he just woke up from a nap. You know, we don't understand him, and so that's why we watch. But because we're watching, anything he does creates news and sells tickets, so the advertisers are happy. And it is sick, but it's our own fault. It's not everybody else's fault. It's not OJ's fault. It's our fault because we're watching. And I think part of it is that we're all watching in the hope that maybe he will go to jail this time. We're so mad. He's walked on so many things, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's kind of sick, too. I mean, as much as I dislike OJ Simpson, I don't want him to go to jail because I'm mad at him. You know, I want the case to be tried fairly and so forth. The other thing I guess I would say is, there's something sinister about the way that television cameras allow the exploitation of a very serious legal proceeding to become the mechanism by which defense attorneys in particular twist things.
Right.
So, yeah, you're right. If people start to say on the daily cable shows, oh, poor OJ, if that becomes a resounding sentiment, if that's what gets printed, if that's what the pundits say, if that's what everybody says, then you know, the middle of the country, the sort of regular Joe, is going to go, oh, I guess I should feel bad too, and they line up like lemmings and act stupid, and then they become the jurors who sit in judgment, and they go, oh, I feel bad for the guy. That level of manipulation is not at all being reined in by the judges. The judges should be more responsible. The judges should do everything in their power to close the doors, keep the press out. And when I say keep the press out, I don't mean that we shouldn't be watching. You know, my preference would be to be able to have as much watching all this stuff that the government does, even in the court system. I'd like to have more true attention to what goes on in our courts. But the notion that you can make a soundbite story out of what happened that day, it becomes the means by which the defense attorneys manipulate the outcome by, you know, throwing false stuff out there, by doing dog and pony show strategies. I mean, Michael Jackson going to court in his pajamas.
Right.
And I write about this in my book at some length. Michael Jackson going to court in his pajamas was a big fraud. It was a show. It was designed to make people feel bad for the guy. Because, you know, you look at him, you don't want to kill him because he rapes children, or you want to feel bad for him because he's pathetic.
Yep.
And he played the pathetic card. It was the only choice he had.
Yep.
And that, the fact is, we allowed that to happen. Our legal system allows that to happen. And there's nobody even trying to put a stop to that because it sells tickets, it makes money, and that's what America cares about.
And to learn more about that, pick up Wendy's book, And Justice for Some. Wendy, it's always a pleasure.
Mine too, Dana. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio with Susan Murphy Milano and her story and her book that we're going to talk about, and it's eerily similar to what we've been talking about this evening. You are listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
We're back with more of the Dana Pretzer Show on ScaredMonkeysRadio.com.
And that's right, we are back. If you go to this webpage, www.movingoutmovingon.com, you'll see a story about, obviously, the book is called Moving Out, Moving On, and some information about my next guest, Susan Murphy Milano. She's a respected author and nationally recognized expert and has been a tireless advocate for battered women and children. In January of 1989, Susan's father, a Chicago violent crimes detective, murdered her mother and then took his own life. That very night after discovering their bodies, she vowed to change the way society viewed domestic violence and broken relationships. We started last week with Denise Brown. We've continued on this week with Wendy Murphy and talking to Tim Miller and covering the Stacey Peterson disappearance in Illinois. And I thought I'd bring on Susan Murphy Milano to talk about her case and this growing trend of the wives that are disappearing, sadly, law enforcement officers being involved, etc. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. Good evening.
It's, you know, there's never an easy way to cover a topic like this, domestic violence. Again, you heard me mention Denise Brown was my guest last week. We covered it heavily. Faith in the system, Wendy Murphy and I just talked about courts and judges that don't do their jobs, and are we covering this the way that we should? I want to start with the Peterson case and get your thoughts on that, and then get into what you've been doing to help victims.
Well, I actually have been writing a blog on the Peterson case, and that has really fueled me because there's a lot of things in the situation going back from wife number three, Kathy Savio, that should have been red flagged. We still look at domestic violence as domestic, woman, not important. And in cases of officers, we continue to look away. We look the other way. Blue still defends blue. Not in all cases, but in many. And I think that in Bolingbrook, this was a classic case. A woman died. They didn't investigate it properly. Now the state's attorney has come in because of another woman's disappearance, his current wife, Stacey Peterson. And what I've seen a lot happen is that the victim, Stacey Peterson, has sort of been put on trial for being married at a young age, somebody that's older. We continue to blame the victims for their circumstance. And I think that if this case can bring that out where that should not happen, we have to stop doing that with these victims. We don't ever put the abuser or the alleged offender on trial or talk about his past. We always seem to talk about the victim and point to it as if to say, aha, you did this and so you're to blame, that's why you're in this situation. And that's not true.
It's hugely crucial what you're saying because when we look at these types of cases, we've heard a lot about Drew Peterson. We've put Stacey Peterson, like you say, on trial because of her young age. Why would she get involved with this cop, etc.? But one of the big aspects here that I think the media is being a little bit weak on is the fact that those that live in relationships, those women that live in relationships with police officers that are getting the crap beat out of them on a daily basis, who are so terrified anyway to come forward with their complaint, but now with the fact that hubby is a police officer and she would have to report him to his friends, that faith in the system must just totally go down the toilet. What can we do to help with that?
I think Wendy Murphy brought it up earlier when she talked about officers who, you know, they bring home the streets, and they do. When you come and you fight crime and you come home, you have no release mechanism. You have no release mechanism for a lot of times. It's for the officers who go to the tavern at night, and they do hand-to-mouth at the bar stool.
Right.
It's not okay for an officer to say, I'm having problems at home, I'm having psychological difficulties, I've just been on this murder case over here down, you know, in another area, and there's no release for them. Secondly, an officer's wife is not taught, and I mean taught, how to deal with her husband who's a police officer. If across the country they could be taught, they could go through an orientation, they could be taught
how to defuse the ticking time bomb, because he is. He's brought home the whole world. He has no way to release that other than, in many cases, to abuse, to hurt, to harm, to threaten, to control his family. And that happens time and time again. We're seeing these cases with increased concern in various states. You have a lot of officers lately who have murdered their wives. Some are walking out on bail. Some just stood trial. Some are waiting sentencing. There's a Lautenberg Act, which says that if a police officer is convicted of a misdemeanor, he will lose his job. That's a federal law, and yet it's not enforced in most places. It's not enforced, particularly, it seems, in the rural areas. We still do look away. And if in these police officer cases where there is abuse, if a wife could have a place to go, because they often do not, they can't come forward. If the Attorney General's office in each state would take the lead and safely assist them, because they don't have the same, you know, the side of the car says we serve and protect. Clearly, it does not apply to an officer's wife or family. It does not. And I've seen this time and time again. And I have nothing against police officers. I think that they serve and protect, and they are wonderful. But there are that group that continue to abuse and control in their own home behind closed doors.
Departments, chiefs, boards of police commissioners, you name it, obviously in these sorts of cases have failed when it comes to protecting their own, so to speak, from committing these sorts of crimes, from educating and training officers. I'm curious your comments on the training that law enforcement gets when it happens to deal with domestic violence, and the training that maybe their family should be getting on how to deal with these sorts of cases, because when you come home, you can't obviously immediately take off your police uniform and forget about all your troubles, and you start taking them out on your family, like you say. Let's talk about the training aspect here.
First and foremost, the Fraternal Order of Police nationally across the country, that's a union for the police officers, need to get on board with this. I believe it's in Michigan and one other state. What they are doing now is they are fighting any accountability by the city council, by the state. They're using the union as a protective coat of armor, if you will, to say that we won't allow this, we don't want this investigation of officers who are potentially dangerous in their homes. We'll police our own. They do, when you sign up a spouse for the job and you sign them up for insurance, one of the first things that need to happen is a special training, a special class
right. For
officers' wives. They don't know what to do. They should know how to disarm a firearm. They should know what those firearms can do. They need to be taught self-defense. They need to be taught techniques, debriefing techniques, if you will, the same that are used, you know, when our men and women from war come home. There's certain things that a healthcare professional will help the family with. In that respect, that should also take place here. We need to look at it as a serious problem. If the department start taking an active approach with their officers, if they start to pay attention, if also from high rank on down, it's said that it's okay if you have a problem, you can come to us, because the weakness is within all departments across the country. If he has a problem at home, or he can't control his family, or he can't control a situation, then he's not going to be able to protect the streets or his partner and solve and do his job on the crimes that he's out there doing every day. He has to be allowed to say, it's okay, I have a problem. But they're not. Officers are not. It's not okay for them. It's not okay to say, I need help. It's not okay to say, I have an alcohol or a drug problem. It stereotypes them. And then their fellow officers often look at them like they're not capable or able to do the job.
Some of your projects back to 96, your book Defending Our Lives, and most currently Moving Out, Moving On, you do what you can to help those that are in battered relationships, abusive relationships. Tell us about both of those projects.
Well, Defending Our Lives, Getting Away from Domestic Violence and Staying Safe, is at any library across the country. And it's free, so it also has a safety plan. You know, any offender or abuser has a plan of attack. You need one as well. You need to be the best actress you know how to be. If you think about it, no two cases like our fingerprints are the same of domestic violence. They are all separate, unique, and different. You must have a plan of what you're going to do, enlist family and friends to assist you. You must tell people what your next steps are going to be. If it's where you work, you must let your employer know. You've got to be safe about this. And sometimes in some cases, and this is what I've seen in a lot of the recent murders, is
that the women have told the person that they're married to that they're leaving and that they're going to get out. And I don't think that they follow their instinct or their intuition in some cases. And they need to have a different kind of a plan for safety, for their life. If somebody is that clever and cunning and is able to do them harm, they may not let them go out the door. They may do something to them so that they can't leave. They may hold them hostage. They may do bodily harm to them. You've got to have a plan of action. Like I said, he's got one for the abuse. You need one as well. In an officer situation, it can become more difficult. But what Kathy Savio did, which was Drew Peterson's wife, number three, is she wrote a letter to the state's attorney, which stayed in that permanent file. And it's come out now. She couldn't have gotten the order of protection that she received without that letter that she wrote.
Right.
In that situation. You've got to document everything. You've got to tell friends and family. You've got to send emails. You've got to be able to carry your cell phone with you all the time. So if you need to take a picture of something, you've got to know that if you're being stalked, to file a police report. If you're being having harassing calls, to file a police report.
And then, you know, and it's so important.
The offenders do this because they're cowards. They do this behind closed doors where no one can see. They get away with their behavior.
Yep. And we have to, as a society, both in law enforcement, as a public, broadcasting, authors, you name it, we have to do what we can to get a confidence back in our system that those who are victims are able to come forward. I've interviewed Jackie Hollander many times, although a victim of rape, and all these years later, you know, still lives with the scar. This isn't something that just goes away. You go away if your spouse kills you. If you survive and you live and you're able to get to safety and stay safe the rest of your life, you still live with this trauma and this stigma, I guess, because victims are put on trial a lot of the time, as many of my guests, including Wendy Murphy, have said. What is the message that you put out to those who are so afraid that they may be the ones made to look bad?
Well, they need to go to, you know, the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence is 1-877-799 SAFE, S-A-F-E. That's one place to start. There are legal services, the Legal Aid Foundation, which is in every city. There's also the Women's Bar Association or the Bar Association in your phone book or your yellow pages. Churches are a great place for support as well. You know, the message should be from the public is that we shouldn't tolerate this, that we talk about it as we have, particularly in the Peterson case, because it's on the national hot plate. I'd like to say that it's like serving turkey on a platter. Let's take this apart and see what we can do. The message boards are loaded with pointing fingers and speculation, when in fact we should be angry.
Right.
We should be upset. We should say, okay, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to stop this from happening to somebody else? God forbid it happens to somebody that is a senator's daughter or a judge. Then you're going to see some changes. We still look at this as not a crime. Domestic violence is a crime, and it's against the law. And the laws were passed because people lost their lives. They died. So the pen that was signed for legislation was not of a pen of ink, but a pen of blood of all those women.
Right.
Cries for help fell on deaf ears. We've got to start taking this just as seriously as we do with drunk driving.
Absolutely. Well said. The website is Moving Out, Moving On, movingoutmovingon.com. Susan Murphy Milano is the author. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm going to keep the phone lines open for just a couple of minutes, about 4 or 5 minutes, and see if you're interested in calling. Of course, these are difficult topics to deal with, but nevertheless so important. 306-842-7884, 306-842-7884, if you'd like to sneak a quick phone call in. And I know we've all been amazed and watched these types of cases, in particular the case of Stacy Peterson missing. And we see the tiresome hard work of those Tim Millers, Beth Holloway Twitties, the prosecutors, the Wendy Murphys, the authors. Couldn't you imagine the trauma of what Susan Murphy Milano has gone through, and yet to come forward now and to dedicate her life to helping those that have gone through those types of situations. It's just incredible the strength that these people are able to bring forward and to work on. I just find it fascinating and heartwarming as to how hard they work towards this. Again, 306-842-7884 if you want to sneak a quick call in. We will finish about quarter after the hour. Of course, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. You'll be able to pick up the show on podcast a little bit later on this evening, and of course you can hear our daily commentaries and everything else that goes along with that. And don't forget that Scared Monkeys can be found at scaredmonkeys.com. That's scaredmonkeys.com. You know, we can continue watching the cable coverage. Greta Van Susteren's been doing an excellent job on the disappearance of Stacy Peterson. Other channels have and shows have been covering it as well, and hope for the best. But I think, you know, sadly, we have to look at reality that Stacy Peterson won't be coming back. But there's always that slim bit of hope that she will. And of course, if you have any information on that case, or you know of something, even if you think that it may not be important, make sure and pass it on. There's all sorts of toll-free tip lines, web pages, Call America's Most Wanted, whatever. You can be kept anonymous, and your information leads to, you know, every piece of information can lead to a successful conclusion to a case. That's how important these cases are. I do want to thank my guests this evening for coming on. Pam Bosco, Tim Miller, Wendy Murphy, and Susan Murphy Milano. And remind you that our show will be back again in a few days. And check out the replay of past shows at scaredmonkeysradio.com. Thanks for listening. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.